Hi everyone, today since we're talking about the new BBC show, Seven Worlds, One Planet, I wanted to talk to two kangaroos. The first episode is all about Australia, and we get to the point where we talk about how kangaroos are the best animal on the planet, but happen to be a little bit dumb. Do you have a comment about that, Mr. Kangaroo?
Yeah, I do. I think kangaroos are really smart, you know? We're actually quite intelligent creatures. We like
Hello.
To...
Hello? Hello, is this Domino's?
No, this is not Domino's.
I'm Kangaroo too.
What do you say to people who criticize your intelligence?
We don't all like pizza, you know. We're actually like to...
Hey, calzones!
We don't have calzones in Australia, you know. We have pies. We eat meat pies.
Hello, is this Domino's? Can I have a koala?
This is not a delivery phone call. I'm trying to interview you guys on behalf of Bad Science, a podcast.
I swear to God, all you Bad Science listeners, we are not so stupid.
Do you guys read books? Have you read any books recently?
We read lots of books.
One time I put a book in my little pocket and I thought it was my Joey.
Well, she represents... the 1% of kangaroos here in Australia.
Okay. Well, I don't know. Jury's out, I guess. It seems like half and half at this point.
We're really smart. We're not dumb.
And a Diet Coke, please. Bad science. Did the movie get it right? Bad science. Or will we
have to fight? Science. Hi everybody, welcome to Bad Science. I'm Ethan Edinburgh, and today we're talking about the new show Seven Worlds, One Planet, and the first episode specifically, which is all about Australia. And so very fitting, we have two unbelievable guests here. I feel very fortunate, very lucky. First, of course, is my favorite generic Australian actor. It's Zach
Garrett. Without the last name Hemsworth.
Yeah, well, yeah, there's a few that I would consider, but besides them, my favorite generic Australian actor, Zach Garrett. How's it going, Zach?
It's great, mate. Yeah, thank you for having me.
No, please, thank you for being here, and you just came back from Australia recently.
Yeah.
So you'll be able to tell us all about the geography of Australia.
Mostly flat.
Yeah, okay, thank you guys for listening. Joining us is the producer of the Asia and Australia episodes of Seven Worlds, One Planet. It's Dr. Emma Napper.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too, Dr. Emma. Thank you for being here from Bristol.
Yes, from Bristol. Yes. I haven't been called Dr. Emma ever. I like it. It's good. Yeah, Thank you.
This comes up a lot on the podcast, actually. A lot of scientists, they earn their PhDs and then they don't go by doctor. They don't introduce themselves by doctor. And so I like to make it a point to really hammer that home.
No, it is. Well, it's something you've earned.
Yeah.
You've studied for ages and you've become the repository of this, incredible wisdom. And
yeah.
Yeah, I know so much about the tiniest area of science. It's unbelievable. I'm an absolute expert on that.
It's still mind-blowing to schmucks like us.
Well, on that point too, it was interesting when you sort of break down. So you're a doctor of zoology, is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. And then when I was looking into it, particularly with relevance to your episode of the show, you've got zoologists, biologists, ecologists, meteorologists, climatologists, all these ologists from across the
Hundreds
field.
Hundreds of ologists, yeah.
Wow. And this is just within the realm of biology, as it were.
Right.
My God.
You need experts in every tiny field to come together to make something as phenomenal as Seven Worlds, One Planet. It really is so good. I'm sure by this point, it's already come out. So everybody go check it out. It's so flippin' unbelievable. I mean, it's reminiscent of Planet Earth, Planet Earth 2, Life, all of these shows. And it's just, I don't know. You guys capture stuff that has never been seen before on camera. I don't know. There's just so many. I don't even want to just throw things at you, but there were so many sections of this show that I just never had seen anything like it. We were talking very briefly about that huge bird, the cassowary.
Yeah.
I just didn't know that existed.
Yeah.
So for me, that was already mind-boggling. So just to get us started, how did you take an interest in this? I mean, were you just always into animals when you were young? How did you get involved?
So I grew up in a city in England, in Manchester. So there was no grass or trees or anything like that. So I totally escaped into the Attenborough programs when I was little. I just absolutely loved watching them. And then would kind of pick up anything I could find on the street, like little ants and things like that, and take them into my house and be like, look, I've got animals. I just love the natural world from his programs.
Yeah.
So he totally inspired me to then go on and study zoology. And then, after a lot of begging to the BBC to let me come and join in with the fun. I eventually kind of got a week's work and then another week's work. And
so that's all it takes to work for the BBC, just begging, just weeks and weeks of begging.
A PhD in a very tiny bit of science.
Seven years of study?
It was only four. It was only four years of studying. And then about three of those at least continuously begging. And yeah, eventually a chance to work.
You just wear them down eventually.
Yeah, eventually.
And this has been in production for 4 years. Is that correct? It took 4 years to make this show?
So Seven Worlds, One Planet, 4 years from us being given our brief to the program coming out. So,
wow.
So 4 years ago, make a program about how the continent of Asia has shaped the wildlife, the continent of Australia has shaped the wildlife. Go. And then
sure.
Easy. And then dramas.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. It's a third of the world's land, Asia. And they were both kind of really fun challenges. But Australia especially, like, is the most wonderful country, and especially when you're not Australian and you land there and everything is different from the rest of the world. I mean, what a treat. I love that.
And so, Zach, why is Australia so nice?
So nice in general?
I've never been. So sell me on Australia 90 seconds ago.
I feel as though because it is such a hostile place naturally, you got to be nice to get by.
Which goes against
the order of nature, you know, which is, of course, survival of the fittest. But that's probably why so many of our animals are so angry all the time. Like cassowaries themselves are beautiful, stunning creatures. Like, but they're the size of, to give you an idea, they're the size of the velociraptors in Jurassic Park, basically.
Right. Yes.
But my mate's actually terrified of them and emus. He hates them. He's scared to death of them.
Yeah, deadliest bird in the world.
They are the deadliest bird in the world.
I was going to say, I'd probably be terrified too if I saw one in real life. Ooh, loved watching it on the show, but if I saw it in the same room as me, I'd flip out.
No, you wouldn't. It's not a great thing. No, you don't want to be caught in a small space with them, particularly if they've got a headache. But like, they've got the three talons on their foot, and the middle one is designed to get up under your rib cage.
Whoa!
So when they kick, they perforate your diaphragm.
Oh my! It's designed to kill humans.
Yeah, essentially. I mean, that's of course a strict generalization. But in the show, there's a beautiful shot that you procured of them walking on the beach.
Yeah,
and you're very close to it. How did you do that? How did you get so close to a bird with such a fearsome temperament, territorial temperament, I think is probably the right way to describe it.
So he's a really special bird. And I think quite often, it sounds like nuts, but these sequences come down to individual animals and a lot of research to find those animals. So he was a bird that we knew about because he does this little route every day where he walks down onto a beach and back again. Most of them live in the deep forest and don't do that, but he does this little route every day.
Wow.
And happens to be near a campsite, and so he's kind of used to seeing people around, so he's not as scared. So it was a lot of work to find him, and then we just sat on the beach. We were like, okay, well, people say they see him down on the beach. Let's sit and wait. And then one morning he just walks out onto the beach, and he's the most beautiful bird, stunning, and just beautiful colors and totally chilled.
They shimmer too, don't they?
Yeah.
Like the feathers on the back are almost glossed.
Yes. Mm.
So they've got this sort of shimmering kind of, it's like Beyonce with sequences.
Absolutely. It's Australia's Beyonce.
Yeah, it's Australia's Beyonce, exactly. And you don't want to meet Jay-Z, man. It's just scary. Oh, mate.
Frightening.
Yeah, it's very frightening. But yeah, they're quite captivating to look at.
Yeah.
And what struck me too is so funny, and that the bird is obviously striking. That's a very dismissive way to describe it. The cassowary is striking. But in the documentary, when these particular rainforests where they exist, and one thing I didn't know until I watched the doco was they're 100 million years old.
180 million years old.
The Dane Tree rainforest. And they've got defense mechanisms on the trees that are there to defend against dinosaurs.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So those forests have seen all sorts, and the trees there they're primed. Even though a lot of those animals have gone, there's spikes. There's these small plants across the ground that are like barbed wire.
Whoa.
I mean, it's just, that forest is booby trapped. When you go and try and work there, you're just kind of walking through, and there's.
So yeah, how do you traverse? How do you get around there?
We're not magic, just like really carefully and trying to get spiked or stuck in things. And
oh, man.
Yeah. It's a hostile, that forest doesn't want you there.
Right.
And it's really, the animals there are tough, and it's not, It's not a holiday working there. It's really beautiful, though. Really beautiful.
It is. Yeah. No, it is. It's intense.
Yeah.
It wasn't until I took my girlfriend down there, who's from Alabama. She's from the States. And I was working down there on a job about 3-4 years ago. And we were there for 12 weeks. Right. And we went up to Mount Tambourine, which is this, again, a very ancient part of Australia. It's only probably about 45 minutes from the Gold Coast, which is the beach surface paradise. You head up inland and it's an old volcanic area that's been extinct now for millennia. Mm. But it wasn't until I brought her there that you start to realize how much is actually around you. Because when you grow up with it, you talk about watching the wildlife docos in Bristol or in Manchester, in Manchester, and you know, being drawn into that world and seeing what's out there. When I grew up, we were watching a lot of shows and going to zoos and seeing things and then seeing the animals themselves in our backyard.
Yeah, right.
Whether they're cockatoos or funnel web spiders or king parrots or snakes or something like that, they're just there. My parents live in Byron Bay and they've got a water dragon he's a big one too. He's probably about half the length of this table. He sits on the front veranda.
Oh, and Dad, I want to live there.
Dad feeds him peaches.
Yeah.
He feeds him little peaches.
I just remember as well seeing like kangaroos for the first time. I know it sounds ridiculous, but like so much of the wildlife in Australia, you don't, even if you work in this job, you don't know about it. But kangaroos you know about, right? It's in kids' book and everything. But to see one in real life, you just look at it and go, that is not real. Like, I can't even believe
it
that
doesn't
really
look real.
Exists.
I gotta say, and I know it's probably super cliche, but like there were several sequences of this episode that I thought for a second were CGI. And then I had to take it back and go, well, obviously it's not CGI, you idiot. It's all this is the most real footage that exists on the planet.
Yeah, I'm like that with squirrels. That sounds stupid. This is the most stupid thing, but I will stop in my tracks to see a squirrel on the side. I've lived here now for 6 years.
Yeah.
But I will stop if I see a squirrel.
Yeah.
Or a chipmunk or a raccoon or something like that. I lose it.
Somebody else in Australia said, like, British garden snails are, like, so engaging. They're amazing. It's kind of what I love about Seven Worlds, though, is that you've got your own – everyone's got their own continent where you're like, hopefully we can even surprise you about your own continent.
Yeah.
But then, you can look at everybody else and go, no way, you know, like – There's hamsters in the Europe episode. I mean, they're pets, right? Nobody. And then you watch them in the wild, and you're like, wow, I totally didn't know that happened. And so that was really what we wanted to show, was like your own place. Look at this wonderful thing. Hopefully, surprise you. But look at the amazing diversity around the world.
That's
very cool.
It's 100% right, and particularly like in our country, obviously, you grow up. I was never taught to fear them. I was never taught to fear anything growing up. You were just taught to respect it, understand that it's there, and you sort of go, if you see a taipan, you know, probably just head in the other direction.
Yeah,
as a rule. Yeah, but I remember there was one thing I heard always stuck in my mind. I was surfing in my home because I'm from Newcastle, Australia, and I was out the back one day, and there was a couple of guys out there, and they were talking about a shark attack that had just occurred a couple of beaches down only 2 days before. And they were talking about whether the shark was still out there or not. And there was a pause in the conversation, and one of the boys went, well, he'll either get you or get me. Shrugged the shoulders, and that was it.
That was it.
Yeah. And I thought I think that's the way Australians approach nature down there, which is, I think, maybe it's fatalistic. Maybe it's something we absorbed from the Anglo-Celtic culture that, of course, colonized the country for the last 230-odd years. That sort of fatalism, that acceptance that there is something bigger out there than you as a human being. So it's best you just respect it and accept it.
Yeah. That's right. It's respectful. And that's nice, isn't it? That's kind of, calm and respectful. And I mean, things could happen, but you hope if you're respectful to it, generally it'll be respectful to you.
Are there any animals that you're not respectful of that you just think you can go and get stuffed? You know, not particularly keen on you whatsoever.
Yeah. You ever kicked a panda?
Oh man.
Pandas are such
a pain.
It's their fault, really.
Yeah. It's their fault. I don't like mosquitoes very much. I've had enough of them.
Yeah, same.
I think
really any flying insect I have an issue with.
Really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've got a bone to pick. I don't even know if they have bones. I'm just saying.
They do on the outside. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Exoskeleton? Okay, yeah.
Okay, there we go.
You've got an exoskeleton to pick with their thorax.
Yeah, so yeah, nice.
Such a, just rolls off the tongue, that very common phrase.
It's so smooth.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you. You were mentioning how you got told that the cassowary was on the beach by somebody. Is that part of the pre-production process? Do you just go around and talk to people that are around and say like, hey, are there any neat animals I should go check out that I've never seen before?
I mean, it's all the ologists you mentioned at the beginning. That's that. Yeah. So we talk to lots and lots of different people before we go out. So a year speaking to hundreds of different people around the continents, experts who live in the field and people who are studying it. And that's how we know that. And then quite a lot of the stories come out of like maybe a scientific paper, new papers, or then you and most of the time, you know, we go really like with a good idea of what to expect and with somebody with us who knows that animal, so we can help us read their behavior.
Yeah.
And then there's things like the dingo sequence where...
That was like, a great sequence.
Couldn't have been more different. It was that was just... I was desperate to film dingoes. I don't know why. I just had this thing that they're such an iconic like Australian animal, and yet they hardly ever filmed. So so I was like, I could have maybe worked out if they hardly ever filmed. It's because they're impossible to film. But we just rang around a lot of places until we found there was this lovely ranger in Namadji National Park who was just like, "Yeah, I saw dingoes." I was like, okay, that's enough to go on. That'll do. Let's go.
I'll take it to him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Which national park did you say that to?
Namadji,
okay.
Yeah, it's just outside Canberra.
Yeah, I was going to say, because it looks like the Southern Highlands. It's almost, and I think, again, that's what your documentary does so well, is capture the geographic diversity of the country.
Oh, man.
There's that wonderful shot of the wombats in the snow, which is not something you often attribute with Australia, but when you consider there is an alpine, if you will, area. It's just kind of like, you know, it's just sort of two things slightly pushed up out of the ground.
Yeah.
You know, but that's obviously being very dismissive. But that area where you shot that kangaroo sequence and where the snow was with the wombats and things like that, that's where the fires have been.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. Yeah, right on the edge of that. So that's, Kosciuszko National Park's been badly affected where those wombats are, and also the area where the dingo. All of those kind of drier areas. That's exactly where the fires are at the moment.
Well, I know we are going to put a link, if you guys are interested, in the description of this podcast to where you can donate and try to help out with these fires, which is, please do everything that you can, because from what I've just seen on this episode, Australia is one of the most magnificent and diverse places on the planet, for sure. I didn't know I'm an idiot through and through, for sure. Nobody is denying that.
You've started podcast. I can't start a podcast.
It's not that
tough. Can you
have
a podcast, Dr. Emma?
Let me
peek behind the curtain here. It's not that tough. But my point is, I didn't know that there was snow. I didn't know that the wombats, I remember they could only survive on like a little bit of grass for like weeks at a time. I thought that was fascinating. And then most of it, I knew that there was like a desert area of Australia, but I didn't know that so much of it is dry. I think I wrote down, it says rain hardly falls on 70% of Australia, and that there's literally like huge sections of it that are changing color, right? That they're like rusting because it's so dry.
Yeah.
Tell me about that? I found that absolutely fascinating.
I just remember the first time I flew to Australia, you start flying, you can start seeing the desert and all the shapes down below, and then I fell asleep. Now 6 hours later, I woke up and there's desert still there down below. I mean, it's especially coming from the UK, which is, let's face it, tiny. Like, it's Australia's desert is just absolutely unbelievable, and the way the animals survive there is just they're really, really, really hardy.
Yeah, they're tough.
Yeah,
it is really tough. Yeah, it's unforgiving at times. There was only recently, 2 weeks ago, people, because they always say if your car breaks down in the desert, don't leave your car, because you can see the car easier from the sky than they can you.
Whoa. Yeah.
So people, the car breaks down, they wander off and they die, and they're usually found within a mile or so of the car.
Oh, my God.
And there was only a case this recently where someone survived out there for 4 days. Three people, there was a party of three people, two of them didn't come back and one did, because they went out to go and find
out. Why were they driving in the desert?
Well, people, it's beautiful out there. It's stunning.
Well, sure.
Yeah, if you can survive.
Yeah.
It's part survivor, but my girlfriend always says to me when she flies to Australia, she hears the survivor theme in her head, like from the moment she lands at Charles Kingsford Smith Airport.
Yeah,
but my dad drove trucks for 30-odd years, and I used to go every now and then. I'd hop in the truck with him and go out and have a look, and he traversed a lot of the country. And one day he took me out west to a place called Cobar, which is a long way from where you shot some of the incredible sequences with the Parenti and the Thorny Devil and things like that, but it's at the cusp of it. Once you get over the Liverpool Ranges and the Great Dividing Range and things like that, you head west and you go through these lovely little towns, Mudgee, Bathurst, things like that, very cute little, very anglicized, English-looking type little villages. They're very pretty. And then you reach this point. There's a town called Ningen, and you turn left over a railway line, you turn right, and you go straight, and that's it. And I remember going along, and there was a period of time there where I realized we hadn't passed a car for an hour. maybe more. And then when you reach Cobar itself, which is at the cusp of the outback, I remember standing there one night and the sun had just set and it was so flat you could see the curvature of the earth.
Oh, man.
You could look over the earth. It just hit at the right time where the sun was just below the horizon and you could just see the slightest bend in the earth.
Wow.
And that's what captivated me. But then when I lived in Ireland when I was younger and we flew from London over the UK over to Dublin, I couldn't take my head away from the window to see those beautiful rolling green hills and those gorgeous little towns and things like that, and then clouds. You know? but it was such a difference. And when you fly from Sydney to Hong Kong, you fly for 7.5 hours, 6 hours, and then when you leave Australian airspace, the pilot actually makes an announcement. He says, "Ladies and gentlemen, we're now leaving Australian airspace." You watch and go, "Jesus Christ, this 6 hours?
Yeah,
yeah. God, yeah, damn, this place is big."
Yeah,
and it's also funny to me that I'm sure everything that you're saying is completely legitimate, but if you were making up all those town names, yeah. It's just like,
sometimes
I don't know.
Do. Yeah. Did you get the drop bear thing when you were down there? I mean, you're a doctor in zoology.
Oh, drop bears.
Did
right,
you get the
okay.
drop? Did someone have the audacity to try the drop bear thing on
yes,
you?
Yes, they did. So this is the animal that lives in the trees that falls out and kills you. Is that what it
that's
is?
Correct. That's correct.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. No, I did get the drop bear line. Yeah.
What is this?
This is something, I mean, I don't know if we're letting him in on a secret here. That's what I'm worried about. Mm. I don't want to blow it for.
I mean, that's kind of the point of this podcast. Yeah. Give me Australian secrets. That's what I want.
There's a thing called a drop bear, which supposedly is, you know, obviously you've got grizzly bears, black bears, things like that. This is a cousin or a relative within the koala family that lives up in the tree.
Okay.
And it actually falls down and grabs your face and suffocates you.
What?
Yeah.
Well, I got told it chewed your face off rather than suffocate you, maybe. Yeah.
That's frightening.
These are quite serious creatures. I mean, I don't know what part of the-
What do they normally eat?
Just people.
Yeah.
Just
get
people.
Get out of here.
I'm not trusting either of you.
Humans have been there for 60,000 years. So.
This doesn't exist. You're both effing with me.
It was just actually a news report in Australia with a Scottish journalist from the BBC where they put her in all this safety gear and brought a koala out and said, they got her hook, the poor bugger. She's going, so this is the drop bear? Okay, hold it. She said, this is apparently a very serious creature. Yeah. And then people are cracking up in the background. She said, you're taking the piss out of me, aren't you?
Yes,
although,
we
you
are.
Know, koalas are pretty moody. I think if they could, they might. Yeah, they are surly. Yeah,
wow. I wanted to go rewind for a second because you mentioned the thorny devil, which was something else that, of course, yes. I did not know existed. And there's a sequence of it, and I want you to describe it to the folks at home.
Okay, so the thorny devil is a little lizard that lives in the middle of the desert, and it's about the size of a mouse. So
oh,
if you
I didn't
were,
realize that.
Yeah, it's quite small.
Okay.
And it's got a lot of, it's just very tough. It's very small, but it's very tough. And its special trick for surviving the desert is that it can basically suck water out of the sand. So it when it does rain in the desert, you get these tiny little puddles. They're just like a millimeter deep, a couple of millimeters deep. And it puts in its foot and then sucks the water all the way up its skin, like a straw, all the way to its face, and then kind of... does a funny little gulp thing with its head and drinks the water sucking it up from its feet. And it's a very, very, I mean, it's just a hardy little animal, you know. It's they're kind of my favorite, the ones which are tiny, but like you say, people can't survive in the desert. This thing's fine, you know.
I mean, it's a total superhero animal.
Yes,
I've never seen anything do that. A.
No.
B, it's designed by somebody who's like on mushrooms having a nightmare. The thing has like thorns, horns all over it. It just looks like no one would ever design something like this unless it's a defense mechanism.
You know,
you don't want to mess with this thing, it seems like.
Yeah.
But yeah, I couldn't believe how it just absorbs the water. It just sucks it up through its feet into its mouth.
I knew a drag queen in Sydney named the Horny Devil.
Okay, similar.
She
used
that?
To take the stage dressed as like Priscilla Queen of the Desert as a thorny devil.
Nice.
Her stage persona was the horny devil.
Was it? Is it?
It was absolutely brilliant.
Is it like a much more well known creature in Australia?
She could absorb champagne like the thorny devil absorbs water.
Sucks it up through her toes.
But what you mentioned about evolution, that's really interesting. And I wanted to raise this point with you about the blue-ringed octopus. And this is one of my favorite creatures. And what I loved about this doco is you guys didn't necessarily go towards, you know, the terrifying elements of the, you know, the various creatures down there that have all the kinds of myotoxins, atraxotoxins, hematoxins, neurotoxins. They've all got awful toxins in them. Some do, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
The blue-ringed octopus is the size of a golf ball and kills full-grown adults through this tetrodotoxin or something that it has in it. Can you explain the evolutionary purpose of a poisonous cephalopod?
Wow.
Didn't know you were going to be tested today.
I'm just curious. Because like, we're talking about isolation and evolution in isolation.
Right. They mentioned that in the episode too, that that Australian animals have evolved in isolation, right? Yeah. Because it used to be part of what was called
Gondwanaland.
Yeah, Gondwanaland. But now they're alone.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I the blue-ringed octopus, why it's quite so poisonous, I don't know. I mean, there's absolutely buckets of sea creatures that have toxins like that. I guess it's quite a dangerous place to live, but I don't know why it's quite so feisty, because it's incredible.
I mean, it's probably been doing that for however long now. It's like surviving millions of years.
Yeah. And it's a horrible way to die too, because you're conscious while it kills you.
Oh,
like, it stops you from breathing. So it shuts down all your voluntary muscles.
So evil.
Well, the only reason I know this is because my dad dived, and he was given a guidebook to creatures to avoid while you were diving.
Yeah.
And the blue-ringed octopus, they said you basically suffocate.
It's on the front page of this book.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, do not pick this animal up.
Yeah.
And it's they're beautiful. Like they glow bright blue. These are great things to put on your Instagram page,
absolutely.
To see. When they're pissed off, they go this neon blue color.
Whoa.
It's like, you know, it's like Hollywood Boulevard on a Friday night.
Yeah.
And these things, but when they bite,
it's a shame because it makes you want to go towards it more.
Yeah. And do the star tours. Yeah. But it's got this, toxin in it that stops your breathing while you're fully conscious.
Whoa.
There's no antivenin. So the only way you can survive is just through CPR for 24 hours.
Oh God.
Yeah.
It's like impossible. Mate.
It's staggering, because I was curious about it, because I've asked, there's a guy in Australia called Dr. Carl Krisanicki, who's a famous scientist down there, and he's like everybody's favorite science teacher from high school. And I asked him once about the funnel web spider and how the Atraxa toxin in this thing is not fatal to a border collie. Like Katie, like, you know, Emily's dog, would get bitten, not a problem in the world, but a silverback gorilla would die within 30 minutes.
Man, so weird.
So
let's have an octopus on the show, and
we'll ask it. So, is there any purpose to this? Do you think, evolutionary wise, or is it just an accident?
No, I mean, there's so many poisonous animals because lots of things will want to eat it otherwise, and a lot of poisonous things are bright colours to warn people. I don't know what particularly would have a go at the blue-ringed octopus, but I imagine any kind of big fish and stuff. Yeah, it must be a defence against that. Yeah. But I'm not sure, but it's a pretty beautiful animal. It's really beautiful.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Hey everyone, this is Jesse David Fox, host of Good One, a podcast about jokes. I am proud to announce that I have personally won the Streaming Wars. And there's a new docu-special on Peacock based on our own Vulture podcast. Good One, a show about jokes, follows Mike Birbiglia as he develops new material, taking audiences through the process of transforming personal stories into stand-up. Featuring interviews with Mike's family and comedy colleagues like Seth Meyers, Hasan Minhaj, and Asko Akatsuka, Good One, a show about jokes, is streaming now, only on Peacock.
The break is over. Here we go, back to the show about science.
I also wanted to ask, there's a part that I loved in this episode where the bats, I don't remember what kind of bats they were.
The flying foxes.
Flying foxes. Where there's like 10,000 of them, right? Mm-hmm. And like one by one, they just skim the surface of the water because they're thirsty, because of course, Australia's super dry and they just want some water. And so they skim the surface of the water with their bellies, with their little tums, and they get them wet, and then on their own will like drink the water from their stomach, right?
Yep.
And then, but it's a risk because there's crocodiles in the water. And so every now and then a croc will at the perfect time jump up and, you know, because they've been there for millions of years too, right? They're like pre-dinosaurs.
They're pre-dinosaurs,
crocs.
Yeah.
So they just have this great ability to take out bats every now and then. So were you on location at this event?
So I wasn't on location at that. I have filmed a crocodiles and caiman and things like that before, and it is the weirdest thing because they are so they're so calm, and also when you're filming them you know where they are because you've been watching them, right? So
right.
you know where they are. You've looked around your boat and there's a couple on your left and there's a couple on the right, there's a couple behind you. It's fine. You turn
doesn't
away.
Doesn't sound fine, by the way.
Oh, well.
For you, I guess.
It's the ones
you see you don't have to worry about. It's the ones you don't see.
Yeah. Right. This is the thing, is that you'll turn and you'll do something and be like, okay, cool. We got that shot. We'll turn back, and they're just closer. They're not attacking you. They're just closer. They're just closer and closer and closer. And it's like, I don't know if you guys have What Time Is It, Mr. Wolf here. It's a
really?
What is that?
It's a kids game where one person like stands facing away from everybody else, and you have to get closer and closer and try and touch the person, and then
game.
It's a spooky game, but these crocodiles just
ends with a child's death.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah. But yeah, that's
sweet.
They're the sort of predator that just you think it's okay. I am in charge of this. I can see you. Everything is fine. And you're right. It's not fine. They're just getting closer and closer and closer. And
have they tried to take a swipe at you guys when you're on a boat? Because they come out of nowhere. I mean, it's like lightning fast speed that they snatch these bats up.
And the other thing is that they can just wait. So you kind of forget as well. Like, you know, even if you're paying attention, humans have got like an attention span of a few minutes really. And they can just sit there. They can just, it's an hour and a half later. They'll just creep a bit closer.
It's been millions of years. We're cool.
Exactly.
We're chilling.
We could wait another 10 minutes to get closer.
You make that point in the documentary. David does in his narration. He says how there's some animals that are just meant to wait and there's others that are meant to move. And it's so true. Like you've got when the kangaroos in the dingo sequence are bouncing across the country. And even their movement's a survival mechanism. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but macropods, like kangaroos, do they have the most efficient form of locomotion in the animal kingdom?
Whether it's the most efficient, I'm not sure, but it is very, very efficient. And that's why they can move across Australia. They're incredible. They're very, very fast and they can just keep going. They're incredible animals. They're very, very
so,
cool.
Yeah, unbelievable watching them. Because I thought at first, because I'm used to seeing dogs. I'm used to seeing, a wolf every now and then in a documentary. So I see, to me, it's just like, oh, they're super fast. Nothing's going to outrun that. And you see in this sequence, the kangaroos, and it's tough. This dingo has a hard time trying to catch a kangaroo. That hop is insanely effective. They are quick. It's pretty cool.
Their slight weakness is they're not that clever. Oh. So
that's true.
It's true.
Nobody tell them.
It's really awkward, but it's true. So they're fast, but the dingoes can slightly outwit them, which is why they were.
I think one
on
of
the
them ran into a rock. Yeah. Is that correct?
Yeah,
which
is
not.
It's like what my dad said in the truck. Is they're sort of dopey. They sort of just stare.
It makes them cuter though. It makes them cool.
Those big doughy eyes and the ears. Absolutely adorable. not bright.
So that's what the dingoes got on her side is just maybe a little bit more brain power.
And the dingoes, correct me if I'm wrong because I'm very often wrong. The dingoes were brought to Australia or are they native to Australia?
They probably came across with people about 4,000 to 8,000 years ago. So they may or may not have been like bought deliberately. Mm. But like Australia, you can think of Australia as like this a complete isolation. And then in the last few thousand years, things have come across from Asia. So the bats came from Asia and dingoes came across for about 4,000 to 8,000 years ago.
Why do you think that is?
Why did they come across?
Yeah.
There was actually an ice age there. So there was a bit of a land bridge. So it wasn't as ridiculous as it sounds. It was much easier to cross then. There were lots more islands. Mm. They could have come with people as well. They could easily have been brought across by a wave of people. Indigenous people have been in Australia for 60,000 years, but that wasn't like one set of people coming across. Lots and lots of people have come across.
Loved
across
Australia back then. It's a hot place. Literally hot.
Yeah, literally hot. But it even goes back to the colonial times too. There's evidence of Chinese explorers up around the top end in the 17th century.
Ooh.
Checking things out. And the Dutch and the French, if it wasn't for Arthur Phillip and the First Fleet, La Perouse was going to get to Sydney first. The French explorer.
Okay, so where can we listen to your history of Australia podcast?
I think you might know. Yeah, you know.
I like this.
It is. It's really interesting. And I just finished working with an Aboriginal actor in Australia named Mark Cole Smith, whose nation's from the Northwest Cape, not far from where you shot that incredible sequence with the sharks, the Kimberley area. It's obviously further in, but that section of Australia, which is massive, his nation's from up there. And he was talking stories about how, and I think they just did, there's the anthropologist, I think in the UK recently said, Aboriginal Dreamtime stories are identical across several, so similar across several nations, they're pretty certain that they're articulating the Ice Age itself.
Yeah, right.
So the stories themselves are actually accurate.
Wow.
To this land bridge that you're talking about with the dingoes coming across. So their stories, their lineage, their storytelling reflects the actual ice age itself going back 60-odd thousand years.
And you guys also had a thing that you said was 60,000 years old, the petroglyphs, right? Oh, the drawings on those rocks. That was absolutely...
That was an awesome part of it.
Unreal. Yeah.
That's an incredible place up in Northwest Australia. It's the longest, like, there's a million drawings on like this. It looks like a giant's throne, like marbles all over the landscape. And on each of the marbles is like a drawing going from 60,000 years until relatively recently. And it's just this amazing, like, catalogue of the animals that have been there. It's absolutely incredible, mind-blowing stuff. And I think hardly filmed before, and just really, really, really so grateful to get permits to work up there. It was very, very cool.
I couldn't believe that I'd never seen that before. It just seems like that's a wonder of the world right there.
Like, is it called the devil's marbles? Is that what you're talking about up there, or is this
no, it's
that's my friend Brian. Devil's marbles.
His reputation precedes him.
Yeah, he's pretty cool.
No, it's a boulder field, but it's just incredible catalogue of all these like amazing animals. You're right, and it's those animals exist on the rocks, they exist in storytelling, but obviously they're gone now.
Yeah, I was going to say there's one that was extinct, like it is extinct already, and then there's another one, I can't remember which, the Tasmanian devil, I think it was, that like could be extinct soon.
Oh, the Tasmanian.
I don't know where we're at on that. I don't know if you have an update for us, how many are left, but I thought that was really tough for me. I mean, I'm a sensitive guy, you know, by nature.
That's true.
But that was a tough segment to think about. This adorable creature that could be on its way out because we're a bunch of assholes. I guess, is that the right way to say it?
Well, that's what I think has affected people so much with the fires. Has been seeing the effect on the ecology of the place,
right?
But the devils have this awful facial tumor disease, which is spread, unfortunately, just through their natural behavior. Is that correct? Where they fight each other?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I feel like I could have picked one of 100 different animals in Australia to do this story on, but we picked the devil just because I love it and it's cute.
They're awesome.
Awesome, yeah.
They're creatures, yeah.
But a lot of Australia's animals, all these amazing mammals, most of which like people will never have heard of, like, you know, quokkas and bettongs and all these different things. Yeah. And they, people have pushed them into these tiny little pockets where they're only surviving in small, very small populations in tiny little protected areas. And that's why, from a wildlife point of view, that's why the fires could be so devastating, because we've pushed them through lots of different reasons into these tiny pockets. And if a fire goes through that now, that's that animal extinct.
Jeez.
And we've got some footage of an extinct animal in the program as well, which is just a piece of footage I remember seeing a number of years ago and just being heartbroken. I mean, why does it matter? But how sad to have lost such a beautiful animal. It's called the thylacine or Tasmanian wolf, but it's just a beautiful animal. I'm just gutting that we've lost it.
It's just because it's so unique. I mean, it's such an amazing, that creature in particular, but if you think about, you know, we talked with Johnny Keeling about losing a white rhino that he saw, and he was describing it to us. And again, it's just something that you can't replicate. There's no other, you know, the fact that we don't have any more or will not have any more for the rest of time.
Yeah.
It just makes you feel really small, insignificant, and like a scumbag.
Yeah.
For not dedicating your life to saving all of these animals.
Yeah, yeah. Like, but you can. That's the thing. That's,
here we
you
go.
Know, we, yeah.
Please save us.
Well, the Devil's Ark in the Barrington Tops. Did you come across the Devil's Ark in your time there?
What's the Devil's Ark?
The Devil's Ark.
I know about Noah's Ark from my Jewish school years.
This is slightly more animals, I would say.
Oh, more animals. Yeah. That's even better.
It's less monogamous. Let's describe it as that.
Okay, good.
Maybe, yeah. No, the Devil's Ark is a massive initiative that's been undertaken not far from my hometown.
Right, okay.
In the Barrington Tops. I'd love to get your opinion on the Devil's Ark.
Yeah, I mean, it's a breeding centre, isn't it?
It is,
So on the mainland... I mean, people are trying to do so much for the Tassie devils. Barrington Tops is absolutely the edge of it's on fire as well. So that's it's those little refuges where people are doing their hardest to protect the animals. They're very vulnerable at the moment. I think very, very vulnerable. Yeah.
And are there any plans to encapsulate most of Australia in a fireproof dome, or how does that? I'm thinking on my feet here, guys. I'm trying to solve this now.
Yeah, so like one big fire blanket, just whew, there
one
you go.
Huge fire blanket dome.
Wish we had one.
I mean,
that's a good plan.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. No, it works. I mean, it sounds practical. Can't be any worse than what's been happening down there now. Look, it's funny. Like, you probably would have been told this when you were down there, but fire is so essential to the ecology of the continent. Without fire, some plants don't exist. Mm. Like the Banksia is a famous example of if it doesn't germinate unless it comes across fire.
Okay.
So it's, and the Aboriginals, of course, used it for agricultural purposes over 60,000 years. There's a book called Dark Emu at the moment, which has recently been released, which goes really deep into Aboriginal agricultural practices to live off the land. And they were quite complex and quite sophisticated. So it's very deep. But these things are just absolutely unprecedented, and is, of course, an end result of climate change. And even down there, just speaking colloquially with people, just speaking in just passing, like my grandma's 86 years old, and when you chat to her, she goes, "Yeah, no, I don't know what this is. This feels strange." And
it's new.
Yeah, a lot of people have been sort of, you can just sense it down there. I don't know whether you had that experience when you were down there. Did you feel as though things seemed off? Did you have any sort of...
Were you having fun, or was it the end times?
What was it, spring break, or was it, Revelations?
I've been doing this for 13 years and we are always getting told by people all over the world, this is not how it was.
Really?
And yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think with Australia, it's slightly the canary in the cage in some ways, because it is very hot. It's very dry. It's dry. It's got hotter by a few degrees in the last few years. Mm. And what's crazy is, you're right. It does need a lot of the animals, some of the plants and the animals. They do need some level of fire to survive. And even in Australia, where that's true, they can't survive these fires. It's even though they've evolved with fire, this is beyond survival. And that's what makes it kind of crazy.
Well, then may I ask the question then? And this is for a lighthearted comedy podcast.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm just curious.
It always gets here.
We were talking about the wombats earlier.
Yeah.
And there's been conversation. And this is just colloquial, and this is just simply hearsay and conjecture. And I don't know whether you as a zoologist would know anything about this, but there's stories of wombats who are quite – do you ever have like a cranky neighbor living next door, the kind of guy who would bang you on the roof here with a broom saying, "Hey, kids, keep it down up there,"
that kind of thing.
Wombats are kind of like, they're quite surly little creatures.
Okay.
And there was two famous ones in Adelaide Zoo, one called Fatso and Notso. And Fatso was fat and Notso was not so fat as Fatso. But yeah, anyway, I digress. They're surly. There's stories of them in these fires having other animals come into their burrows with them. This is true. It's absolutely fair dinkum. I swear to God, this is not drop bear territory. This is fair dinkum. So there was a story of a farmer who had in Victoria, not far from where you saw that sequence with the kangaroos and the dingoes. He saw a goanna, a couple of echidnas, and a wallaby come out of a wombat den.
Yeah, wow. True. So the wombats are. You're right. I mean, they are grumpy and they are tough.
I love them because they're such dicks.
Yeah, they're just that's how they've got by. That's how they've got by. They're not fast. They're not trim.
They're just surly.
They're surly.
They write letters to the editor. Dear BBC.
Yeah. They're that man. Yeah,
Cecily
yeah.
Wombat from Hull.
Yes, like, exactly. Yeah. Disgruntled wombat. Yeah, but they survive. The reason they're in the snow is because they. Which is where they are in the program. We film them in the snow. It's because they dig very deep burrows, and that's how they survive. Dig with the deep burrows, and it's a godsend for the animals in the fire. So it's not deliberate. They're not trying to help the other animals, which I know has been suggested. I doubt they're trying to help deliberately.
Yeah.
But those burrows are a place where other animals can escape to. So yeah, those wombats are heroes. They're definitely providing shelter for some of the other animals, which is very cool.
For all those wombats listening, thank you so much.
Yes, for your
gratitude.
They
probably will dismiss and shrug their shoulders.
Leave me a nasty review.
The Yelp reviewers. I don't think they're that.
They don't mess with it.
They're more sort of call up and complain. To the manager type animals.
Yeah, yeah.
They're more direct.
So my boss will hear from
them. Yeah, totally. Tell you, you hear from me on Monday. They're those kinds of guys.
Well, we have to start wrapping it up, unfortunately. Both of you are my best friends, I feel like, and I just want to talk to you for hours. But I did want to mention this, that at the end, which I always love these segments, you guys have a little behind the scenes making of the Australia episode. And there seemed to be an issue. You guys were following these dingoes, or that one dingo, I should say, really for like 5 weeks, something like that, 6 weeks. And
really?
It was a, seemed like a grueling process, and there was some footage of a guy getting like torn up by ants. Do you know this man? Is that a common thing?
I loved seeing that footage. Loved it when I found that. Yeah, so that was the director, Theo.
Okay.
One of our better looking members of staff, which is good. And he trod on an ant's nest and just got absolutely nailed by them, and yeah, had to strip down to his pants.
May I ask what ants these were? Were these the jack jumpers or the bull ants?
I don't know. They were big black ants. Big black ants about that big. But whatever they were, they bit. And the crew also came across a brown snake, which you'll see in that as well.
Oh, right. Yes.
Yeah.
There was, so scary.
They can be stroppy too.
Yeah. But that is working in Australia. It's booby trapped. The animals are amazing, but it's just booby trapped with stuff like that.
Did you have any difficulties or close encounter with... an issue, an injury?
Me personally.
Well, I mean, yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm too hard for that. No, I was fine.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's pretty impressive.
I've been there enough times. Yeah, I was. I'm
sunburn.
Good. Oh, yeah. A dodgy beer and stuff like that.
you got to avoid that 4X up in Queensland.
Oh my goodness me, it's awful. Yeah, that's the worst thing that happens. That's the worst. Okay. It's about yeah. That.
But everybody's okay.
Everyone's okay.
Okay.
Yeah, we're used to it. It's just part of the job.
I got bitten by a huntsman.
Oh.
I've been bitten by a few things.
Yeah, yeah.
I had a huntsman under my shirt collar. You know the huntsman spiders?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
These are the really, they look really angry.
Whoa.
And there's they're sort of like this.
Okay.
And they get up in your shirt collar.
Yeah.
Mum used to hang our school uniforms up over the chairs at night, and they crawl up in your shirt collar.
Yeah.
They're about the size of a dollar note if they're really big.
Whoa.
And this one was not small. And I remember I felt the leg touch my neck and I swatted it. And I pushed it so hard it bit me through my shirt.
Oh, damn.
I've had one encounter with those. It was a while ago. Somebody picked one up and I said, do those things jump? And he said, no. And it jumped straight on my face.
Oh, man. That's classic.
They cause car accidents. They get in people's visors.
Whoa.
No, this is true. It's the seventh leading cause of car accidents in Australia is huntsman spiders. They get in people's cars. They get up in your visor.
Oh, so
and
scary.
It happened to me. I pulled the visor down, driving from Newcastle to Sydney one day for something. And it landed on my hand, and I threw my hand to the ground. I was like, far out! Chucked my hand like that.
Yeah.
Pulled the car over. Got it. I don't know why, but I rang my dad up and was like, there's a huntsman in your car.
You bastard.
What do you want me to do?
You sick freak. Man. Yeah, that's really scary. I mean, I'm scared of spiders in general, but if they were in my car and my visor, I'd probably crash and kill a bunch of people.
You just accept it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where should I go if I was to visit Australia? Where do you think is like, oh, you have to go to this place?
For me, it's the rainforest.
Yeah.
It is. You walk in and you think, I know dinosaurs saw this. That's exactly what a dinosaur would have seen.
Man.
It's cool.
But isn't that also the booby-trapped area you were talking about?
Yeah, but that's the experience. That's part of it too.
Okay.
Yeah. You get got by stuff.
You got to lose at least one limb,
I think.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
I think for me it would be probably the – because I'm a coast. I grew up on the coast, and probably Byron Bay area is really pretty.
Okay.
It's a stunning area. It's an old volcano there, Mount Warning, an old volcano was there, and it's ecologically, it's beautiful and lush, but it's also really quite, it's quite undeveloped still up there at the moment. There's no traffic lights for like 30 miles.
Whoa, cool.
So it's a very pretty spot. And the ocean, they're just getting killer whales back there now too.
Oh, wow.
They had killer whales there till the 1950s, but then the whaling drove off, they killed so many humpback whales and drove the killer whales off because their prey disappeared.
Yeah, right.
But the whales are coming back so strong now, they've just sighted killer whales up there.
Whoa.
For the first time. And that means that there's less sharks now in Byron Bay.
Huh. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, because the killer whales eat the sharks and there's been a lot of shark, there's been shark attacks up there.
Yeah.
And there's great whites there, they're big. But yeah, the killer whales are coming back, which
means...
So
that's the next program, the killer whales versus sharks.
Yeah.
Sounds great.
Like something either the Sci-Fi Channel will have or you guys will have.
Yeah.
Honestly, sounds like we should just kill a bunch of people. Now, hold on. I know that sounds violent. It sounds bad.
Hear me out.
I think it will save a lot of animals.
You're saying Thanos was right.
I think he was onto something. Yeah. I do. And we're going to have him next week, so I am going to ask him. No, but I do want to give you guys a plug section here. Is there something you'd like to tell people about, something you're involved with coming out?
I think I'd love to hear you plug first, like with everything you have coming out.
Well, definitely Seven Worlds, One Planet, I presume.
Seven Worlds, One Planet. Please watch the series, watch the Australia episode. I hope it's going to make you, laugh and cry and get involved. It's a very, very, very cool place. And the series explores the different continents and you'll see a lot of stuff a lot of new stuff, a lot of beautiful stuff, a lot of emotional stuff.
It's one of the most amazing things that I've ever seen. I'm sure you feel the same way. It was completely just unbelievable, the series.
It is.
And we worked on it for 4 years, and I'll cry if people don't like it, please. No,
oh, everyone's going to love it, Emma.
No, it's amazing. It's so, and no, bombings. And the reason you're portraying it this Saturday, and I found this in my research to come in here today, was, and David Attenborough said it on his voiceover, is because of the fires. Mm-hmm. So this episode was supposed to take place further into the season, but because of the horrifying events that have happened down there, they've brought it forward just to show the diversity of Australia's wildlife.
And yeah, that's right. So the fires aren't in the episode because they happened afterwards, but the episode shows the diversity of the country and what we might lose in the fires.
Totally. Yeah.
Wow.
No.
My plug is that.
Yes, please.
I've got a movie coming out this year called Rainfall.
Great.
With Ken Jeong and Daniel Gillies, comes out in the middle of this year in cinemas.
Okay. And look out for Rainfall.
It's a sequel to a movie we made called Occupation, which is on Netflix now. If you want to have a look at it. So this one, Rainfall, will be in cinemas middle of this year.
Great.
And I've got another one called Seance coming out soon. That's what I did this year. I was in Australia working on Rainfall till the middle of December, and then we wrapped. I was surfing on the beach, and within 3 days, I was in Pennsylvania in the snow. And it was the first time in my life I'd ever seen snow.
Oh, wow.
It was amazing. So I went from like the height of summer down there was 106 degrees to 11 degrees Fahrenheit, you know, for us with the metric system, shall we say, 40 degrees Celsius to minus 12. It was amazing. It was great.
And your body passed out.
Yeah, basically. I lost three fingers.
Yeah.
And I've shortened my life by 3 decades.
Yeah, yeah. I've noticed that one of your eyes just doesn't open now. Yeah. So that's cool. Well, Zach, Emma, thank you so much for joining me, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, mate.
Bye.
Bad Science is hosted and produced by me, Ethan Edinburgh. Our associate producer is Emily Feld. Our editor is Lucas Bollinger.
And the executive producer is Brett Kushner.
Follow us on Instagram at Bad Science Show. That's at Bad Science Show. Or feel free to send us an email, badscience@seeker.com. That's badscience@seeker.com. Let us know what you think about the show, any movies we should do in the future. I always appreciate getting your emails. And of course, leave us an iTunes review. That lets other people hear about the show. And I'll see you all next week. Bye.